This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Even if you think this is a crazy idea, I can guarantee you that farming is far crazier. It's absolutely far crazier. Just look 12,000 years ago at the human population and look today at the results of farming and what it's meant for the human population, and you can see exactly where I'm coming from. An indoor farmer doesn't have to pray for rain.
9 years ago on Sea Change Radio, we spoke to the self-proclaimed founding father of vertical farming, Dixon Depommier, about the concept of moving crops onwards and upwards, literally. In an interesting twist, the global COVID pandemic has resulted in a lot of abandoned office buildings. To proponents of vertical farming, these spaces may represent unprecedented opportunity. We thought this seemed like a good time to revisit our original Sea Change Radio interview with Dr. Depommier, unedited in its entirety. In fact, Dr. Depommier co-authored a paper just last week for the Proceedings for the National Academy of Sciences, titled Wheat Yield Potential in Controlled Environment Vertical Farms. In the paper, the authors write that, although it is unlikely that indoor wheat farming will be economically competitive with current market prices in the near future, it could play an essential role in hedging against future climate or other unexpected disruptions to the food system. Now, let's go back to our interview from November 2011. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Dr. Dixon Depommier. His book is The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. Dr. Depommier is an emeritus professor of public health and microbiology at Columbia University. Dick, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much.
So this idea of vertical farming is not a new one. Can you walk us through a little bit of how the idea has evolved?
Sure. Back in the 1930s, when hydroponics first came into vogue, people began to imagine raising food plants now, crops, off of soil and in buildings. And so that's when the greenhouse industries basically started. UC Davis was the place where hydroponic farming first became perfected, and nutrient systems began to work out, and they worked on lighting issues and, you know, temperature regimes and oxygen levels and roots and all kinds of other interesting scientific projects. But eventually they perfected it to the point where anybody who wanted to grow plants indoors using hydroponic technologies, which means soilless, water-based growing, could get involved. And in fact, there was a popular movement back in the 30s, as you know, called Victory Gardens, sort of an attempt to grow our own food. It extended into the 40s as well to take care of the issues of supplying enough food for our troops and to keep the home front also well fed. It was a very difficult, delicate balance, and the government encouraged the average citizens to start their own gardens, and many of them relied on hydroponics. And in fact, in the South Pacific during the Second World War, because supply chains were broken by Japanese torpedoes and gunboats, hydroponic farming took off in the South Pacific as well, and we raised some 8,000 tons of food before the end of the Second World War. And then after the war, of course, everybody went back to business as usual. But in the meantime, there were hints that things were not all the way they should be, and of course, John Steinbeck's book, The Grapes of Wrath, one which I do feature in my book as an example of what happened to farming, emerged as the biggest problem facing the 20th century and then well into the 21st century as well. So today, back in the 1980s, let's say, it became apparent that farming and population growth were not going to keep pace with each other. And in fact, with the climate change issues that we began to experience and losses of crops, and still with increasing populations, it became apparent that some other farming strategy had to be worked out. If not for the people that were alive then, that's saying back in 1980, 1990, we were approaching 6.5 billion people at that point. Certainly for the next 2 or 3 billion people that would appear over the next 20 to 40 years, what are you going to do about them, even if you can supply enough food for the people that are alive now? You can't continue to farm this way and expect to feed another 2 billion people.
Now, there are people like yourself and other quote-unquote futurists who are looking at this as one answer to try to feed this inevitable influx of people on the planet.
So that's exactly right. What are you going to do about them? Are you just going to ignore them and stick your head in the sand and pretend that there's no problem? Or are you going to research and find out that there are plenty of other ways of farming that are more efficient and that bring the food closer to where people live? You know, just farming indoors is not the only way to do that, by the way. There are plenty of other outdoor farm strategies which preserve soil and which take advantage of things like permaculture, inserting carbon into the soil in the form of charcoal and things of this sort, which does improve farming.
I saw a really cool picture in the book of outdoor vertical farming in a very modest scale in the picture, but the hydro stacking.
Oh, yeah.
Tell our listeners what that's all about.
Clever approach to saving land and raising an intensive farming at the same time. They are plastic stands with a large, wide, round base upon which emerge four potting zones, all right, or potting plants, I should say. And so you get four per stand, and each one stacks into the other, so you can get multiples of four as high as maybe 10 or 15 feet. So that let's say you can get eight hydro-stacked growing units per, let's say, 2 square feet. I mean, that's 32 plants per square foot.
And why the 15-foot limit? Why couldn't it be 100 feet?
That could be higher than that. Of course it can be. But I think the biggest limit is how you deliver the nutrients to the plants. Because what you're doing is you're doing the absolute concrete thought of the trickle-down hypothesis. You're taking nutrient-laden water, and you're trickling it down through all of those stacks of, let's call them strawberry plants for the moment, because that's mainly what it's been applied to, but there are other plants that take advantage of this as well. And you can actually feed all of these plants simply by dripping nutrients through each of the pots if you line them up in tandem. And that's exactly what the strawberry farmers have done. And in fact, one in Florida saved some 29 acres of land outdoors by doing a single acre of indoor hydro-stacked strawberry farms. So the big advantage of doing it is, of course, that A, you get much more intensive agriculture in a smaller space, but you also get to save the outdoor land to return it to nature. And that's very important, because if we can't save the ecosystems that we've disrupted by farming in another way, then by destroying those ecosystems thoroughly to create more farmland for the next 3 billion people, we will simply put ourselves out of business.
Ed Glaser from Harvard has written a book called Triumph of the City, which is a clarion call for increased urbanization as one of the solutions for the population boom. Do you see vertical farming being part and parcel with this increased urbanization movement, or do you think some of the best ideas out there for stackable vertical farms are separate from population centers?
Well, no, I agree with Professor Glaser's approach to looking at the way people behave, and that is we're gregarious. We tend to associate in groups, large groups. We like those large groups because they offer many social services that you can't get by living as individuals in the countryside. They allow our children to go to higher quality schools. They certainly connect us up with our ancestors and our future ancestors as well. It allows for a higher level of communication, I would say. And I think people in general are programmed this way. I think we're wired when we're born to communicate with each other, and that's where our gift of speech comes from, and all these other wonderful qualities of being a human being. So if we choose to live in cities, there's no reason in the world why we shouldn't choose to grow our food there too.
Cotton. I'll tell you the reason why I said so. I ain't gonna raise no more cotton. I'll tell you the reason why I said so. Well, you know you don't get nothing for your cotton now, and your seed's so doggone low. It's just like a lucky man shooting dice. I said, raise a good cotton crop. It's just like a lucky man shooting dice.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the author of The Vertical Farm, Dr. Dixon Despommier. Dick, vertical farming is more than an idea at this point, right? Give us some real world examples.
That's exactly right. I mean, it starts with the high-tech greenhouse and then builds on that concept. And I mean that quite literally, because today, in the soft cover version of the book that's just recently come out, there are real examples of vertical farms, which I could not have written about when the hardcover version came out in 2010. So just in a year's time, we've had six examples of vertical farms coming into being from absolutely nothing.
Any in the U.S.?
There are two centers for vertical farms in the United States. One is in Chicago. It makes use of an old meatpacking building, and the company is called The Plant. And then there's another one in Seattle called Civesca, which is a two-story building and destined to become a much larger project in the future as well. But the ones that I'm personally familiar with, because I visited them in addition to The Plant, I've been to the one in Korea, which is a government-funded facility. It's three stories tall, and it's designed to be a laboratory for learning how to do this on a much larger scale.
And why is it so much more efficient beyond the distribution issues?
Well, you get continuous growth of plants, for one thing, and you get to intensify the farming beyond weather-related events, right? You don't have to worry about droughts or floods. You don't, if you're designing the building correctly, you don't have to worry about invasion from insect pests. So you don't get a lot of loss of your crops once they're planted from the nurseries. And as a result, if you look at the ratio of success to failures in outdoor farming, in the best situation, by the way, and this is according to the United States Department of Agriculture, about 50% of what you plant never makes it out of the farm onto your table for various reasons. Okay, there's a whole bunch of things that can happen to your plants between the time you plant those seeds and the time you harvest those products and ship them off to the markets.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Dr. Dixon Despommier. His book is The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. How does eco-farming or vertical farming, how do you foresee that possibly cutting down on these pathogenic issues?
Well, for one thing, you don't use human feces as fertilizer, which is very commonly used outdoors, not in the United States, but in other countries, that's very common. The reason why you can keep out these pests is because there's a door on these farms. I mean, you can actually make them a double door. You can positively pressure these buildings to keep out the pathogens, just like we do from an intensive care ward at a hospital. And I know you're going to say, well, that's expensive, you know, and how are you going to afford this? Pat, the fact is that if you consider a business model as a 50% loss, that's what outdoor farming is, and that's in good times, all right? In bad times, and we've had some bad times this year, you can get 100% loss.
And we're probably going to see an increase of this with climate change because the weather patterns are going to be more extreme.
Exactly, exactly. So you don't have to worry about stuff like that when you do it indoors carefully. You have to do it carefully. So that's why these prototypes are incredibly important, because it's going to teach them how to be careful. So a lot of these companies are already growing leafy green vegetables that all you have to do is cut them at their base and put them in a plastic bag and sell them. You don't even have to wash them. They're that clean. So that saves a tremendous amount of worry as to what happens to my plants once they're harvested. You just ship them downstairs to the greengrocer and they're gone in an hour.
And speaking of washing, talk about some of the ways that you think we can start utilizing things like gray water to our advantage.
Sure. Well, there are other uses for vertical farms besides making edible plants available. For one thing, you can take advantage of the fact that plants take water through their roots, up through their stems, and then out through their leaves. The water that they take in through their roots, you wouldn't want to drink. But you'd drink the water that you could collect out of the atmosphere from the plant's transpiration activity. So if you took gray water, for instance, which is human feces and urine minus the solids, and all the dishwater and all the shower water and lots of other water sources, too, that are thrown together in terms of liquid municipal waste, and if you took the solids out, and we'll get to what to do with those in a second, and just took the gray water, which that is, and fed that gray water to plants that you don't eat, but collected the water in the atmosphere indoors, you could use the plants as a purification device. You could recover all of your gray water. New York City, by the way, throws away 1 billion gallons of gray water every day. I'm going to tell you that if you set up enough of these large water purification plants using plants as the final filter, so to speak, you could recover most of that water. And can you imagine how valuable that would be to a country like Jordan or to Abu Dhabi? And New York City just thinks that all they have to do is drill another tunnel up into the Catskills to take the water from the Catskills down to New York City so that they can have a constant source of water. Do you know that the reservoir system of New York is only 2 years full? If they had a 2-year drought and New York City was forced to use water without having any replenishment, they'd run out of water in 2 years.
And yet we hear about New York being one of the lowest carbon impact places for a person to live because of the scale and the density.
That is right. And they still do some things right. I mean, stacking people on top of each other and putting them in a small space saves carbon because there's a sharing of environment that doesn't go on outside, like, say, in the suburbs, where you don't have to drive cars, for instance, in the city. There are a lot of other reasons for wanting to live in large groups like that, too. But let me get to the solid part of this. Human feces is a commodity, basically. I know that most people would never look at it this way, but if you go around the world, about half of the world uses human feces as a fertilizer. Now, there is a danger in doing that because of the spread of human diseases. You mentioned my credentials at the beginning of your show, and you said that I was an emeritus professor of public health and microbiology. Well, the microbiology part of my background involves the study of foodborne illnesses. And so for 27 years, I studied a parasite that's transmitted from people to people by eating raw or undercooked meat. It was called Trichinella. But I studied other diseases also that have their origins in fecal-contaminated food and water. So the best way to ensure these parasites being spread from people to people is to use feces as fertilizer. And vertical farming doesn't even consider that. But consider what would you do with the solid wastes from a community if you didn't use it for fertilizer. And I can tell you what other communities do with it. They throw it away. It's called sludge. And sludge has real value. If you look at the caloric content of sludge, it's a burnable material, just like coal is. It's biological. That's what coal is. Coal is a preserved biological material from millions of years ago. Human feces is what's produced after we eat our food. We convert it to microbes, and those microbes are what we extrude in our feces. Mainly our feces consists of bacteria. Those bacteria can be dried and pelleted and burned. If 8 million people pooled their feces together per day for a year, the estimate is that we could generate some 90 million kilowatt hours of electricity based on the heat that would give off.
It's just almost a megawatt.
I mean, you could use that electricity to run the vertical farms. By the way, it's more than what we have now because we throw it away. So what's up with that?
Oh,
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Dr. Dixon Depommier. His book is The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. Dick, you talk about these vertical farms not just growing crops.
The pharmaceutical industry uses about 25% of its starting material as higher plants. And many of these higher plants are limited in nature. And so they're harvested, and when they're gone, there's no more drug produced. I'll give you a good example. It's called artemisinin. It's a drug that's used to treat malaria. So malaria infects some 2 billion people throughout the world. And there's this drug that's been found to be very effective, derived from a plant that grows on the border between Thailand and China. And the plant is called artemisia, and the drug that it produces is called artemisinin. And that plant is harvested to almost extinction every year because malaria is a very serious problem in many areas. And so the drug is derived from the plant, and when the plants are gone, that's the end. But that's not the end of the drug. What happens is there are some very unethical people out there that realize that there are these shortages, and so they manufacture something that looks like artemisinin. It's Tylenol with some white powder. It's usually lactose that they put in there as well. And they make capsules out of it, and they call it artemisinin. And, of course, it's sold for the same price. And what happens is that somebody with malaria takes this, and their fever goes away because the Tylenol addresses the fever part, but the lactose doesn't come close to killing off the parasites. And eventually these people, many of them, succumb to the infection. So indoor farming would solve this problem once and for all. You can raise all the artemisia you want indoors. You should be able to supply the world with as much artemisinin as they need without having to go through the arduous synthetic process of making this in a chemical laboratory, which they're trying to do to address this problem.
And some of the things that we think of here in this country as being the bedrocks of our food system, like California's Central Valley, you explore in your book and poke quite a few holes in why and how it exists.
Yeah, in fact, I almost didn't have to do that either because Stephen Chu, the moment he took over for the Department of Energy, one of his first statements, like 3 weeks into his administration, was that California, in another 50 years, just won't be able to produce food at all because of the groundwater situation. And also because of diverting water from Colorado. Colorado's contract with California runs out in another 3 years. If it's left to itself without any irrigation, it's a desert. Period. It's the hottest place in California. I mean, it goes up to 110 degrees regularly every year in the central part. And without irrigation, farming will not exist in California. That is a fact. Maybe along the coast, but certainly not in the central part of this area. If you don't account for water and cheap land, you're not going to be able to farm. So the California farming industry is worth about $60 billion a year. Half of it is dairy farming, and the other half is soil-based farming, and it's all flood irrigation. So in the northern half of California, in the Central Valley, the flooding, the irrigation can come from the rivers because the Sacramento River drainage basin is there. And, of course, you get a lot of agricultural runoff going into San Francisco Bay and out into the ocean. And that's a big problem, but not as big a problem as in Southern California, where there are no rivers. So when you irrigate, the water just goes straight down. There's nowhere for it to go except down. And, of course, it eventually reaches bedrock. The moment it does, it starts to accumulate and it starts to come back up again. And it's been doing this for over 50 years, maybe even longer, since the migration of the Joad family from the Midwest to the verdant land of milk and honey in California, as Steinbeck eloquently wrote. And so what you've got now is a horrible situation developing where if flood irrigation continues in the southern part of California, which it will until it fails, then the groundwater will actually reach the surface of the land. And when that happens, all of the contaminants present in the leftovers from the fertilizers will poison the plants.
This is petroleum-based fertilizer largely, right?
That's right. And because when you spread fertilizer over the land, only a small portion of it is taken up by the plants. The rest is waste. And they can't do it any other way. They don't know how. And that's too bad because in an indoor farm, you can direct all of that fertilizer to the roots of the plants and you can get 100% absorption.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Dr. Dixon Despommier. His book is The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. Dick, we had James Howard Kunstler on the show earlier in the year, a noted futurist who poo-poos the idea of vertical farming, saying that once peak oil really takes hold of our economy down the road, we're not going to be able to just keep building up, that our current skyscraper structures are already in disrepair, and just the cost of trying to keep those buildings current and safe would be prohibitive in an era of peak oil. What would you say to Mr. Kunstler?
I think the more precious commodity at this point is water. Fresh water is in far more scarce than oil is. And in fact, if you look at the recent oil discoveries in Brazil and in Argentina, that's going to change the picture of this gentleman's opinion with regards to oil, I'm afraid. There's so much shale oil in Argentina right now that they've recently discovered, and they're going to take advantage of that. And if offshore from Brazil, they've found just a tremendous deposit as well. So the more you look, the more you find, I'm afraid to say. But I think that forget oil, all right? I would agree with him entirely on the concept of oil in general, because I think it's a bad pollutant, and I think there's a flip side to all of this, in that if you look around the world today, if you predict 9 billion people, then we got a problem. But on the other hand, if all of the world can suddenly start to behave like, let's say, Europe and the United States, although we do have a growing population, but it's mostly from immigration, if you look at Japan, if you look at Korea, even if you look at China and India, those places will eventually stabilize. And when they do, they'll stabilize in the direction of middle class. Middle class says, I would rather have a plasma screen television than another kid.
Whether or not it increases, I think solutions like the one you're proposing are important for people to look long and hard at, because even if we stay the same in terms of population, something's got to give.
Here, here. Even if you think this is a crazy idea, I can guarantee you that farming is far crazier. It's absolutely far crazier. Just look 12,000 years ago at the human population and look today at the results of farming and what it's meant for the human population, and you can see exactly where I'm coming from. An indoor farmer doesn't have to pray for rain.
Dr. Dixon Despommier, his book is The Vertical Farm. Dick, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's my extreme pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Breakestra, James Andrews, and James Cotton. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.